We all want to find our place in this universe. We all want to leave a legacy.
Destiny awaits. Come join us on Mars.
Would you be willing to move to Mars? That's an excerpt from a fictional recruiting video tied to the new season of the Apple TV Plus show For All Mankind. That show documents the creation of a city on Mars, and the idea is not totally fictional. SpaceX founder Elon Musk thinks it's possible to create a self-sustaining city on Mars within 20 years. But in a new book on the subject, Kelly and Zach Wienersmith explain why building space settlements won't be easy and probably shouldn't even be attempted until we know a lot more about how to live in space. Greetings, Earthlings. I'm Alan Boyle, one of your hosts for the Fiction Science Podcast, coming to you from the place where science and technology intersect with fiction and culture. Today, science fiction writer Domenica Fetteplace and I are doing a reality check on space settlements with Zach Wienersmith. So come join us on the podcast. Space settlements have been the stuff of science fiction for decades, and they continue to provide plot points for popular sci-fi shows, including For All Mankind and The Expanse. The dream of building space settlements has inspired multi-billion-dollar space programs funded by Elon Musk, who wants to make humanity a multi-planet species, and Jeff Bezos, who envisions an era with millions of people living and working in space. Lots of other people have that same vision. A decade ago, more than 200,000 people registered their interest in taking a one-way trip to Mars in 2023 with a venture called Mars One. More than 2,700 of them were serious enough to pay an application fee. Mars One never got off the ground, obviously, but if Elon Musk has his way, it's only a matter of time before the moon and Mars become destinations for tourists, entrepreneurs, and emigrants. Will Musk have his way? That's kind of what Kelly and Zach Wienersmith assumed 4 years ago when they started work on a book that has just been published called A City on Mars. Kelly is a behavioral ecologist who focuses on the study of parasites, and Zach is the cartoonist behind a geeky comic strip called Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. A few years ago, they wrote a different book about future trends called Soonish, and they planned to follow up with a guidebook for future space settlers. However, in the course of their research for the book, they found that there are huge biological, technological, and legal uncertainties surrounding the idea of space settlement. And in their view, trying to create a city on Mars would be so risky that it shouldn't be attempted until all those uncertainties are cleared up. My co-host, Domenica Fetteplace, has just published a novella that is set on a nearly abandoned Mars base, and so we were both keen to get Kelly and Zach's perspective on the prospects for living in space and what led them to change their minds. So when we began our conversation with Zach Wienersmith over a Zoom connection, that's where we began, with the origin story for A City on Mars.
My wife and I wrote a book called Soonish, which was a book about emerging technologies. And there were two related to space, which kind of culminate in this other book. So we did one chapter, which was about cheap access to space and kind of mostly on the sort of crazier ideas like space tethers, space elevators, and really weird stuff. But we did talk about reusable rockets. And it was this weird thing where it was like, as we were writing, they came into existence, which was a little startling. And then the other chapter we did was on asteroid mining, which I would say we've since become more skeptical of. But we had this weird thing where we would talk to people about asteroid mining, and we mostly, in retrospect, talked to scientists who wanted to do it and entrepreneurs, who, of course, viewed it as more short-term. And we would ask them, you know, well, what are the rules about who can do this? Who gets to throw asteroids back at Earth? You may know that Sagan wrote about this, I think, in 1994, about, like, you know, if we can get asteroids, we can deflect them away. We can also deflect them towards Earth. And we had these kind of basic, what are the rules going to be, sorts of questions. And the people we talked to didn't have answers, not really. So a few were pretty good, but generally no. You know, between the technological development and the apparent, like, you know, open lane for someone to write about how the rules should work, we got interested in a book about, okay, space settlements are coming, and how should we think about how to organize that in a way that's, you know, safe and plausible. And so we ended up doing a ton of research on space settlements from just every angle you can imagine. This was a 4-year research project, and about 2.5 years in, we went from being fairly optimistic about it as a desirable near-term likely possibility. And now I would say, you know, by the end, we thought it was probably unlikely in the near term and possibly undesirable in the near term. It was quite a change, slightly traumatic, I would say.
In addition to writing the book, you also illustrated the book. It's full of these cool illustrations. I'm curious, how did you decide what to illustrate? And were there any illustrations that you had to leave out that you really wish you could have included?
That's a good question. Well, in general, you know, so our last book had kind of just lots of goofy illustrations for jokes. This one, generally speaking, if there's an illustration, it might be a little goofy, but it is actually explaining a point. You know, there's a lot of stuff you want to get into, like distances between things or like what a lava tube is shaped like. So generally speaking, the illustrations are there when it was useful to have an illustration or just to kind of break up the text, especially in places. Like there are parts of this book we really do try to explain how the international law worked or could work, which is like it's thick. And so we try to, you know, fix that by we have a lot of funny stories about the history of space law. We have illustrations and stuff. So we wanted to break it up. I think I'm also, I have a reputation as a cartoonist, and I think that there was a feeling that that should be upheld in this context. So there was a kind of pragmatic aspect. I'm trying to think if there was something we didn't illustrate. I mean, we have an illustration of like, you know, the poop baggie from Apollo. So clearly we were not super limited in what we were comfortable doing. So I actually don't remember an illustration we decided not to do offhand.
Do you ever get a reaction that goes along the lines of, why are a cartoonist and a parasitologist writing up a book about the prospects for space settlement?
A little bit. Not as much as I would have thought. I think it helps. It's funny. It really helps that Kelly has the letters PhD behind her name. People will believe you know anything about anything if you can say PhD. But a little bit, but I would actually say for space settlement in particular, to understand it, it's such a, I hate this word, but it's such a holistic topic, meaning to really understand it, you have to understand a lot of stuff that is just unrelated, like history and geopolitics and law, but also, you know, how to make a toilet in space and how to design ecosystems. And so I would think anyone with expertise in one particular area would have only had like a 3 or 6 month jump on us. So that's my usual response is you know, our main claim to be able to know this stuff is an extensive bibliography of painstaking research. But no, actually, I would say, to be honest, we haven't gotten that much pushback. I think having already written a PopSci book probably got us a little bit of cred.
It sounds as if the bottom line for trying to build a city on Mars or on the moon or in space is don't do it, at least not yet. Is that fair?
I would want to offer a kind of like, don't do it with lots of nuance. So very briefly, and we can get into like more of the particulars as we go, but like, you know, there are a lot of arguments against space settlement that I do think are weak. You know, people will say, for example, why are we spending all this money on space settlement when we should be spending it on, you know, issue of choice? And the deal is we're actually not spending that much money on space settlement. Not a lot of money goes to space settlement in particular, so it's not obviously a trade-off. I mean, unless you're talking to someone who's like, we need to spend $1 trillion now, and I don't think there are too many people saying that. There are other arguments that are, at least in some form, not great. Like people will say, well, you know, what if it's sort of like colonialism? And I, you know, I don't want to open this can of worms, but it's kind of like, it just really is different. Like there's nobody alive on Mars. It's not even like a pristine environment in the same sense. It's like an irradiated poisonscape. So I don't think those comparisons are super apt. What we argue is that because a lot of the biological science is not in, not even close to in, and especially not even close to in when it comes to human reproduction or even animal reproduction, that if you say we're going to have 1 million people on Mars in 30 years and you haven't done this science, then it's effectively something like experimenting on children, because there are a lot of a priori reasons to think it would be quite bad. In the best case, you'd expect an increased rate of abnormalities. Possibly it can't even be done. It might be very unsafe for mothers. I am like libertarian enough to believe that if someone, some adult human wants to sign a waiver and say, I'm going to do this dangerous thing, like whatever, that's their business. But when children come into it, it's different. And if you have a million people, they will. So that's a very straightforward barrier. And nobody, including agencies, including billionaires who say they want to do this, is spending much money on it at all. They're kind of more basic technical problems having to do with like ecosystem design. And we can talk about that too, which is like just a science we don't know much about. And again, nobody's spending on. And then last, the geopolitical framework we have now, the legal framework, the international law, is very conflict prone. And the very short version of that is it's designed for a Cold War world. It doesn't really countenance a world with a huge number of players, including corporations and individuals. So in a world like that, the question mark is, you know, in our effort to create Mars settlements, to make a plan B, make ourselves safer as a species, are we actually lowering existential risk? And I think it's absolutely unclear. And there's a good argument that we might even increase it. So that's the short version that was too long.
But the International Space Station has been around for like more than 20 years, and they are doing some of those experiments that prepare the way for longer duration missions. And then we have commercial space stations being talked about, and maybe by the time the International Space Station has run its course, so to speak, they'll be able to do some of those experiments on those stations. But you also talk about maybe putting more money and more effort into terrestrial analog environments where you seal people up perhaps or try to duplicate the conditions on Earth that you can face in space. And so are those the sorts of avenues that you would suggest to prepare for at least knowing what's involved with the space settlement?
Yeah. So at the very end of the book, having probably come across as fairly pessimistic, we try to offer a kind of realistic roadmap. And the way we say it is essentially, you know, if you gave us a NASA-sized budget to solve the problems you need to solve for space settlement, a big piece of it ought to go to building sealed ecosystems on Earth. So, you know, these kinds of systems, so when I say sealed, what I mean is you're like in a greenhouse where there's not much interaction between the outside air and the inside air, right? So there might be some, like even the ISS is not fully airtight because it's almost impossible to keep something airtight, but pretty much limited. So you're not losing much air and not much air is coming in. And so the only thing that gets transmitted in is energy from the sun. And so the question is, can you build an ecosystem in such an environment that is sustainable, where you grow all your food, you produce the oxygen you need, the ecosystem acts as filtration for human waste, et cetera. And we basically don't have much science on this question. There was some Soviet work done in the 60s that was very limited. The biggest project was in the 90s. It was called Biosphere 2. It was widely mocked. There was a really bad Pauly Shore movie making fun of it in the 90s. And but I would say actually Biosphere 2 was the most successful attempt to kind of do this. So the short of it is, they built a 3.14-acre sealed facility. They claim more sealed than the space shuttle, like really sealed. And they put 8 people in, and they stayed for 2 years, and 8 people came out alive, which is pretty good. The downside is they were starving. They had lost something like 10 to 18% of body weight, and they, you know, you could see pictures. It's not like they had a lot of body weight to lose. These were like, hey, you know, young, fairly fit people. And a lot of stuff had gone wrong in the ecosystem. They had ended up having to like eat beans that were meant for animals. They had tried to have pigs, and the pigs were like ransacking the place. There's a lot of stuff I could go into. The biggest thing is that at one point, depending on how you want to say it, they were something like suffocating. So basically oxygen was disappearing from the system, and it was getting more carbonic, and it wasn't clear why. And basically it turned out later, and there's some chemistry involved. Essentially, oxygen was being pulled out of the environment. Because you know, since you have a nerdy audience, normally what should happen is the amount of CO2 you have should predict something about how much oxygen you have. And it stopped doing that, which is really weird because it's a sealed system, right? Like, where is it going? And it turns out some was coming out of the system. And so, but you know, my view of it is it's very easy to make fun of Biosphere, but it did actually basically work kind of miraculously. So it was meant to do repeated 2-year runs, right? It was going to do 2 years, then 2 years, then 2 years, but do a cruise of 8. I think if that had kept up, we'd have a really cool data set on how to run these systems. And we don't, because it ended in, I think, like 4 months into year 2, basically because there was like financial squabbling and a bunch of other stuff. But like, so if you think about it, like very back of envelope, if you want a million people instead of eight people, we estimate you need a greenhouse the size of something like Singapore. And, you know, and so there might be returns to scale on that. But on the other hand, like Biosphere got, it was closer to the sun. It was in Arizona, much closer to the sun than Mars is. And also it got its electricity off the grid. So, you know, it could scale the other way. And so, you know, this is it. The lack of this knowledge is a huge barrier. There's very little money spent on it. There's a group in China called Lunar Palace. There's a one in Europe called Melissa, another one in Japan called Seif. They're like 2 to 3 people, not fully sealed. So if I was running a space settlement preparation agency, what you'd want to do is build a lot of these systems, maybe make like smaller than Biosphere and modular, so you can kind of see how small you could take it, what are the best plants, bacteria, animals, et cetera, and really develop a science. We don't have it, and you really have to have it to do Mars.
So we need more research on sealed ecosystems, and you mentioned earlier we need more research into a human reproduction and how it can be done safely in space. What else needs to be done beyond that to clear the way for successful space settlements?
I would say those are the two big scary technical hurdles to my mind, mostly because it's not just that we don't have it, it's that it would take a long time to get it if you were starting now with a huge pile of money, which we're not. There are, of course, lots of technical challenges. So like back to a roadmap that we talk about at the end of the book, for us, one of the big things you'd want to do is set up a base on the moon and try to work toward a biosphere-like setup there, which would be extraordinarily difficult. But part of why you would want to do that is because, one, we have a lot of unanswered medical questions about long-term exposure to partial Earth gravity. We just literally know nothing. We know microgravity. We know free fall on the ISS reliably results in very rapid degradation of bones, especially in parts of the body you're not using in space, like your hips and legs, and degradation of muscles, renal stones, degradation of vision, a whole lot of other stuff. And what's amazing is some of that stuff, like the vision degradation, occurred even on the shuttle, which was like 2 week flights. The other gap in our data there is nobody's gone to space for longer than 437 days, which I think was Polyakov in 94. And below him, there's like a couple people who've gone about a year. And then down from that, it's much lower. By the way, it's almost all men, which is obviously a data problem. If you really wanted to settle Mars one day, what I would push for is get the largest moon base you can and try to do a lot of what you would want to do on Mars there. And the reason you do that is not just to answer these basic physiology questions, but what you also need, I really think, is a kind of, this is a weird way to say it, but almost like an employee handbook. Because, you know, like once you're there, there's just going to be a lot of ticky-tacky stuff that you don't think about. You know, like one major issue on the moon is probably the regolith, right? The lunar surface is covered with this dust and fines, that is to say very fine particles, that are jagged. If you put them under a microscope, many of them look like little tiny knives. The Apollo guys reported that it would kind of get up in their suit, almost like it was alive, because it's also charged. And so just sort of managing that is the thing. There's even stuff like, you know, going to the bathroom in space has been historically a problem on the shuttle. They tried out a system where the feces in, I'm sorry, this is gross. Is this okay? So they had a system where it was essentially trying to freeze dry waste and it got back into the system, which is like about the most repulsive thing I can imagine. On Inspiration 4, the recent SpaceX mission, they had an undisclosed toilet problem. So, you know, there's just a lot of basic stuff, best practices that also needs to be worked out.
Space law is a big part of that. That's a subject that takes up a fair amount of the book. And one of your recommendations has to do with clearing up ambiguities in the Outer Space Treaty, which addresses that whole idea of who owns what and who can claim what. One of the big takeaways is that a nation cannot claim territory on the moon or some other celestial body for their country. And so there are still some loopholes, especially with commercial space. Can you take stuff from the moon and do something with it? The United States says yes, but that's unsettled on the international front. And so in terms of clearing that up, that is a big job, and it's even bigger in the current political environment. I do remember some politicians saying, well, do we really want the Outer Space Treaty? Do we want to give a freer hand to commercial companies to make money off the moon or off asteroids? And so it seems to me that the idea of setting up, for example, an international space authority along the lines of the International Telecommunication Union may be pretty much a non-starter in today's world. What's it going to take?
I think that's probably right. I would say what I think is the ideal outcome is, I would say an International Space Authority based on how we manage the seabed, but this is a whole discussion. But so for your audience who doesn't know, the basic deal is in 1967, a treaty was ratified, very widely ratified, including most notably by the US and Soviet Union. And it says a bunch of stuff, but for settlement, the important thing is Article 2, which says nations cannot appropriate territory in space. And so, you know, we found if you're a nerd, you're like, okay, what's the loophole? And so people will say, so SpaceX could set up, but they could claim territory. And it's like, no, because the people there would still be from somewhere. So they would be acting as agents of a country, right? So in other words, like if Elon Musk shows up on Mars and says, this belongs to me, he is acting as an agent of the United States under this treaty. He can renounce his citizenship or something, but that gets into even murkier stuff. And there are other proposals for loopholes, but the basic deal is they're silly. But as you said, the thing that's weird is that the document is vague on a bunch of terms. And in particular, there's an open question about what you're allowed to do with lunar resources. So when I say you can't claim, what I mean is nations can't claim sovereignty. And there are whole books written on this, but the basic idea is like Canada is sovereign over this territory, right? It means they can regulate what goes in and out. They're the sole authority, that kind of thing. You can't claim... You can't like create a new U.S. state on the moon. However, you could, you know, the silliest example is, you know, for imagine a large asteroid. You're not allowed to claim it as territory. You could literally, under the U.S. interpretation, grind the whole thing up, use those resources to build a spaceship and fly away as long as never once did you say this is U.S. territory. So it's sort of bizarre to have a standard where you can't claim territory but can claim stuff. So the U.S. has... perhaps unsurprisingly, pushed the most libertarian interpretation under law signed by Obama and recapitulated in an executive order, order under Donald Trump. The U.S. can basically claim what we want in space. And that's important because, you know, the world is multipolar. Space really isn't. The U.S. is absolutely the overwhelming power when it comes to being able to do stuff in space, but between having the most money for our agencies, our military, and also having SpaceX and other heavy launch players all located in the U.S. And so we have this thing called the Artemis Accords, which the U.S. has released unilaterally, but like 20 countries have signed on, and like not like little countries we convinced to come along. Like the U.K. signed it, but I think Australia signed it. And so we are really pushing this kind of dangerous approach. And the other piece of that, and this is where it pays to be holistic, is that you know, you could say, you know, the moon is big. The moon has about the area of the United States, right? However, the really valuable spots, the spots with water and light, are limited, right? So if you're on the equator, the moon gets 2 weeks day, 2 weeks night, which is really bad for a lot of reasons, right? You know, if you have solar panels, 2 weeks darkness is bad. It gets really cold and really hot, really cold and really hot. At the poles, there are crater rims that are lit almost all the time, and they happen to be right next to the only water ice on the moon. So we estimated, depending on what you count, the actual most valuable real estate on the moon is in the like hundreds of acres. It's eeny, weeny, eeny, weeny. And so if you have a situation where literally under the U.S. interpretation, a single billionaire or a corporation or a country, whatever it is, could show up, use all that water, which will never replenish, and they wouldn't technically be violating the law, that's a conflict-prone situation.
You mentioned the Artemis Accords, and actually China and Russia have something that is kind of going on in parallel, the International Lunar Research Station, and the membership for those consortia are overlapping. Some of the nations belong to both NASA's team and basically China's team. Is that something that we should be worried about, or is that something that opens the way to getting an international conversation about what we're going to do on the moon?
I wish I could answer that. Again, my view, so like my deepest view on this is that I actually don't think there's anything economically valuable to do on the moon. I think there's tons of awesome science I would just absolutely kill for someone to send a robot into the lava tubes. That sounds like the most amazing thing in the solar system. But in terms of like making money, all the cases are really questionable. We go into this a bit in the book. It can get kind of nerdy, but basically I think it's all pretty fanciful. There's really no reason to fight over anything on the moon. It's just a place that should be like Antarctica, where we do science and we cooperate and we learn stuff. It's not worth fighting over. You know, like if suddenly in the Atlantic, an island made of gold appeared, maybe we should fight over it. I don't know. But the moon's not like that, you know? And so that's why I'm in favor of like a big international bureaucracy. I know it would be less dynamic than just letting people from Silicon Valley do whatever they want. But there's nothing worth being super dynamic about. We should prioritize peace. What worries me is that a lot of leaders, people in government, people in industry are, I think because they believe it, though in maybe some cases it's political, are pushing the idea that there really should be a race for these resources and whoever gets them is going to dominate. And it's just not clear that that's at all true. There's not even clearly military value on the moon. It was looked at in the 60s. The U.S. looked at building a moon missile base. And the short version is having a missile that takes 2 days inbound is not super useful. The fight would be objectively bad even if the moon were valuable, but it's not. And economically valuable, scientifically amazing, economically no. And so I do worry that, you know, the U.S. is going to make a move or China's going to make a move, and the whoever didn't make a move first is going to freak out like we did after Sputnik. Only the difference is going to be the space race of the 60s was who can do this thing first, who can like touch the moon. This one would involve turf. It would involve limited resources. And to me, that's a lot scarier.
You write in your book that weird beliefs about human sociology may shape the future in undesirable ways. Could you elaborate upon some of those weird beliefs?
Yeah. So, I could spend all day on this one. I would say there are a lot of kind of folk beliefs about how the world work, where if you talk to people who actually study the thing, they'll tell you it's not. So to give it like a quick example, Gerard K. O'Neill, who's like the big name in giant rotating space stations, he kind of, the moment for that stuff was really in the 70s. He says at one point, I think it's in The High Frontier, that, you know, war is always about territory. And so we'll just make more territory and that'll mitigate war. And this is just like so obviously absurd. I forget what our joke example was, but it would be like if you went to everyone in a disputed territory and said, hey, guys, you can each have an equal sized territory in Antarctica. Like they would be relieved. They'd be like, good. I'm just all about square footage. You know, I mean, it's just absurd. But I think if you haven't thought about it, it sounds plausible. Another one, a very common folk belief, is that most human wealth is in minerals. So there's all this talk about all the minerals we need to get from space. We talked to a developmental economist about this, and he pointed us to a World Bank report that said if you total up human wealth, about 2.5% is in minerals. And of that, it's something like 90% is fossil fuels, which, unless something very surprising happens, don't exist on Mars. So meaning, I mean, I actually find this quite uplifting, right? So it's like, you know, the real value in human life is institutions and technologies and things we built for ourselves. It's not like metals and minerals. We need those things, of course, because that's how we make our stuff. But the real value added, the real wealth is in these other things. So the idea that we're going to get rich by opening up a new resource stream is kind of silly. I could really go down the line on this. let me give one more real quick. So this was for us like the biggest, like we did a ton of research and we wrote like a huge chapter and our editor was like, absolutely not. But it was like, there's this long trend. So one of the things we did for this book is we read a lot of books from the past that were future casting about space. Going back, I think the earliest one was from the 1920s. They really tick up like in the late 50s and the 60s and 70s where like kind of the craziest stuff lives. There is this idea that going to space in some form creates a frontier in the kind of Wild West sense, and that we need that. That if the lack of it is to our detriment, it makes us kind of wimpy and weak and bureaucratic, and we sort of turn in on ourselves. And what's really interesting was one that theory is a theory generally lacking evidence. But what people generally don't know is it actually goes back to a specific guy giving a speech in 1893 named Frederick Jackson Turner. He's very well known in Western history studies, and he's generally considered to have simply been wrong. And I think actually, if you look at the metrics he used to determine that the frontier had closed back then, most people wouldn't agree to it. And then I don't want to get on a tangent, but basically the Old West wasn't even like that. And, you know, a lot of the ideas we have in the U.S. about democracy come from, like, people in powdered wigs living in palaces on the East Coast. So there's just not good evidence that we sort of need to do this thing to get these good social outcomes. I'm going to stop myself.
I love it. Last year, Elon Musk said, I hope there is a self-sustaining city on Mars in 20 years. And your book makes that scenario sound unlikely. But how do you think things would develop to get to a city on Mars, as implied in the title of your book?
Yeah, so I think, you know, suppose we knew there was like a unavoidable comet that was going to destroy Earth and we had to do get as many people off as we could in 20 years. I mean, the first thing to know is most of us would die, maybe all of us. So if you say we only have 20 years to do it and we have to get to Mars, which is extra hard because it's, you know, you only get a launch window every 2 years. I would say, one, you're going to have to do some kind of probably unethical crash course in human reproduction in space-like environments. Hopefully you get some volunteers. I would, you know, I think it could be truly horrific, but there it is. I think you'd want to very rapidly start building out ecosystems, sealed ecosystem designs like yesterday. You'd want to like pour like, I don't know, $1 trillion into just building a huge number of these and getting the science in parallel. And then you'd want to scale up the rockets. So that is happening. Like that's the one piece of the puzzle that seems to be being solved and which has like economic prospects because of communication value. That is kind of the bare minimum. Yeah. I mean, I think at that point, you know, there's obviously a lot of like quite solvable technical stuff, like exactly how to design these underground facilities you'd want to build and a bunch of other stuff. But honestly, I think if you felt like you had to do it in 20 years, I don't want to say it would be hopeless, but it would be genuinely horrific because you would end up in a situation probably where most people couldn't go and you'd have to prioritize. And in addition, just because of our lack of knowledge of medical stuff, like I said, no one's been up for a year and a third consecutively. There might be serious problems lurking beyond some time barrier that we don't know about that would prevent us from living healthy lives or prevent us from having children, or if we had children, prevent them from developing into full adults. And finding that out the hard way could be horrific. But I guess maybe it could be done if we had to. I don't know. It would not be pleasant.
On the other end of the billionaire spectrum, Jeff Bezos has said it would take hundreds of years to have millions of people living and working in space. And he favors the O'Neill habitats, the O'Neill cylinders, the stuff that you actually build in space, because as you mentioned, Gerard O'Neill talked about that in Princeton, and Jeff listen to what O'Neill had to say when he was at Princeton. Does that make sense, or do lava tubes make sense? It almost sounds as if lava tubes are the city of choice.
I think if I had to situate you somewhere in space, a pretty good bet would be lava tubes. So very, very quickly, for people who don't know, you've ever been to Hawaii? I actually haven't, but I've told there are these gorgeous lava tubes. They exist on Earth, but the moon only has 1/6 Earth gravity, and I guess the evidence is that you could get lava tubes like hundreds of times bigger than the ones on Earth, which just sounds like, that's why I say, like, if we're going to do an awesome mission, that's pretty high on my list. But also it's like you get a free place to live, right? That's protected from radiation and other problems. So whereas usually you have to like build a hab and live in it, in this situation, in principle, you could sort of seal off a chunk of a cave and then, you know, have much more volume. As to Bezos, so essentially what we argue is that, you know, the O'Neill vision, which is to make these, you know, millions of ton objects in space that rotate and benefit from the endless solar power that's available, is basically doing space settlement on hard mode, because all these designs, if you go back and read those layouts for these designs in the 70s, they tend to say, well, you'll of course first have to build a mass driver on the moon, or you'll of course first have to build like an asteroid trawler to send stuff back. So like, I mean, to me, it's like, if you can already build a mass driver on the moon, why not just put a mirror or something in space and bounce it down to the moon? I'd rather just live on the moon. Why are we doing this? Like, the idea is, so like, I think of like T.A. Heppenheimer, who was another guy in this movement, proposed like the way you're building the space station is you basically build this giant cone-shaped catcher's mitt and you're just going to fire mass at it. And somehow it's going to collect it and use this infinite solar energy to convert it to, you know, suburbs. It sounds really hard. I mean, I get into the sort of technical aspects, but it's like, by the time we can do that, we can already do a lot of stuff much more easily on the moon, I believe. The only argument I would say in favor of designs like that is it's plausible, or at least possible, that humans simply cannot reproduce without Earth gravity. It might be that there's just something about the process of gestation, conception, development. Somewhere it goes awry without full Earth gravity. In that case, there is nowhere in the solar system but a rotating space station. So that, to me, would be the one case. But I would say if that's the world we're in, it's a world where space settlement is very difficult.
Do you have a favorite science fiction space settlement?
Oh, man. Like, I mean, we were talking before we were recording about how, like, I've literally avoided all science fiction for 4 years because I didn't want to, like, mess up my ability to think about this stuff. So I'm not up to date on all the cool recent stuff. I haven't even...
Okay, well, good news. Yet. You can start.
It's a good question. Well, I would say the ones I've heard are scientifically accurate, or usually the usual recommendations, which probably everyone listening has read, is The Martian and Kim Stanley Robinson's... Color Mars series.
Yeah.
Can I confess, this is the wrong audience to admit this to. I'm a literary sci-fi guy. I'm like a Bradbury over Clark guy. So I'm less
perfectly into, okay.
Like, space realism. Yeah. For realism, I prefer science. But I have read a lot of Clark, but I'm more of a like give me Frederick Pohl. I've read a lot of golden age science fiction, but the literary stuff does it for me. I like the Strugatsky brothers, or weird Eastern European. Stanislaw Lem is another one. Sorry for that disappointing answer.
No, it's not disappointing. We love to hear your recommendations. Speaking of, is there anything that you're reading or watching or listening to that you could recommend to our audience?
In terms of science of space settlement. Oh, anything. Oh, gosh. I'm a really boring person. So my my other thing I do is I write children's poetry. So I'm very into, I have a children's book based on Beowulf. And so I've been reading a lot of Old English poetry. I don't speak Old English. I'm working on it. But I'm trying to remember if I have a favorite book. Let me do this. Okay, let me recommend, I'll tell you my two favorite science fiction books, which are not relevant to space settlement, and then we could do books I would recommend if you want to read more about, like, actual space settlement, not, like, some fanciful treatments. Yeah. My two favorite science fiction books ever, I would say, are Solaris by Stanislaw Lem and Roadside Picnic by the Strugatsky brothers, which is unfortunately pretty obscure for American audiences. In terms of trying to read more detail about these topics, there's a book called Dark Skies by Daniel Dewdney, who's an international relations scholar, but who is very well versed on space stuff. I think he was a member of the National Space Society as a young man. He gets it. But he's actually more pessimistic than we are. He's much more worried than we are. There's a wonderful new book called Off Earth by Erica Nesvold, which is kind of strictly exploring the ethical questions, though naturally that gets into some of the stuff I've talked about having to do with law and reproduction. And one more I would recommend, but only if you want to be really into the weeds about this stuff. There's a book from 2003, seldom read now, I suspect, called Astrofuturism, which is by a guy named DeWitt Kilgore, which is what you might call a historiography of space travel, meaning he went through like what people have said it is going to be like in the past and kind of analyzed that, both in science fiction and in science fact context, which, you know, not a beach read, as they say, but extraordinarily good research. So those, I guess, would be my recommendations.
Well, this is great. I really appreciate the way that you brought science fact to something that has been science fiction for generations. And so I want to thank you for doing a reality check. And hopefully people who are actually doing space settlement could take a lesson from A City on Mars. And so thanks and good luck with the book.
Thanks very much. Thank you. It was very, very welcoming and nice to talk to you.
Thanks to Zach Wienersmith, as well as Molly Reed and Christine Johnston at Penguin Press for setting up the interview. For more about the Wienersmiths and their book, A City on Mars, check out my blog item at cosmiclog.com. You'll find links to further resources about space settlement, including what Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Mars Society are doing to prepare the way for cities on the moon and on Mars. While you're online, check out DomenicaFetaPlace.com. Don't worry about the spelling, just follow the link from Cosmic Log. I'm also linking to an excerpt from The Ghosts of Mars, Domenica's novella in Asimov's science fiction magazine. Thanks to James Emily for performing the fiction science theme music. composed by yours truly. Please subscribe to our Fiction Science podcast and feel free to give us a stellar rating on your favorite podcast channel. And so until next time, this is Alan Boyle advising you to watch the skies.